sports and weather. Brewers lost to Cincinnati. Cubs beat the Pirates. Cardinals were off. So, NL Central this morning looks like this. Cubs in first. Cardinals move into second place, four out. Brewers fall to third place, four and a half out. White Sox lost to Cleveland. Brewers are off tonight. Cubs play again in Pittsburgh. The White Sox host the Indians again. NFL season kicks off tonight. Kansas City takes on New England. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Thursday, September 7th. Cloudy, 40% chance of afternoon rain, a high of 66. Right now, wind from the west-southwest at 3. It is 52 degrees at 8:10. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show are being spent with best-selling novelist Andrew Gross, and we're going to be talking with Andrew Gross about his most recent novel, which is based on true events from the Second World War, and amazing events and an incredible story. The novel is called The Saboteur, and it talks about a death-defying attempt to thwart the possibility of the Nazis developing atomic weaponry during the Second World War. And most of this novel is actually set in the beautiful nation of Norway, which of course fell under Nazi control. And we are, in a sense, on the battle line with Nazi resistance fighters who are trying to reach sort of a fortress within Norway where crucial material is being produced for the Nazis, and at any cost, they are willing to put their lives on the line to try to thwart that possibility. Based heavily on factual accounts of something that really occurred during the Second World War, and Andrew Gross has done a superb job of taking us right there and making us feel like we are in the midst of that chaotic and highly dangerous situation, and also helps us understand what it felt like to be, for instance, a freedom-loving citizen of Norway at a time when the Nazi flag was flying, and what it meant for one's own well-being and the well-being of your own family if you were willing to become part of the resistance. The book, again, published by Minotaur Books, is called The Saboteur, and Andrew Gross, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. Good to be here. That was very well said. I don't really have to do much now.
Great. One thing I would really like you to help us explain is just how closely does your exciting novel adhere to the facts, to this story as it really unfolded? How much here is fiction? And help us understand kind of the mix of the two and the choices you made as the author.
Okay. Well, just as the a little background to it, I published last year a book called The One Man, which was another World War II story and had a bit of a Holocaust component based on the on our family stories. And the thing that links these two books are the attempts made by the Allies to either create their own decisive weapon of the war, the atomic bomb in the Manhattan Project, or, as you said, thwart the Nazis from getting there first, because it was clear, here we are in 1943, both Both the Allies and the Nazis are trying to construct this weapon, and the one who gets there first will likely be the winner of the war. So in research for the one man, I came across this exciting story that was so stirring to me, and really not so well told, especially in the United States, that I said that this is something I have to write about on our next book. So the novel is ultimately the story of a handful of men, and then bleeding down to one man who stand at the crossroads of history, certainly in the war, and it's only their own valor that keeps the Nazis from getting further down the line in developing the atomic bomb. So to answer your question, out of respect for the bravery of the people involved in this raid, and because it really needed no embellishment at all, I kept the actual military side of it as close as possible to what took place, because it's really edge of your seat stuff. And the people involved were not only highly trained, but real devoted partisans and heartfelt believers in something larger than themselves, and that was their own country that they wanted to free, and that and an occupation that they wanted to end. So while I do write fiction, and I write suspense fiction at that, to be honest, I wanted to keep the real story of what took place in terms of there's two raids involved here, as absolutely close as possible to what took place. Now, there's other side stories and other characters in the book that are completely fictional, and I did it because what I really write about is not, you know, military battles and military history. That's not me. I chose this because it puts people, one man in particular, Kurt Nordstrom, who's the hero of this story, in the most exigent and trying of human situations, and then forces them to make a moral choice. And I'm sure as we go on, we'll talk a little about, hopefully in a vague way, about that moral choice that Kurt has to make.
Right. And of course, the heart and soul of this true story, it reads like the stuff of Hollywood film scripts, but it's really important to underscore the fact that the essential facts of the main story are entirely true, historically based, and it's just an incredible story. I think it's also intriguing, and not just because I'm half Norwegian, but I think anybody would agree with me that Norway, in the midst of the Second World War, is an exceptionally interesting backdrop for a thriller.
Yeah, but it's one that no one really has told, before. It's interesting.
Yeah, not very much.
Yeah.
I want you to just say a word, and I suspect you did plenty of research in order to paint the picture as fully and authentically as you do, of, in a sense, what the state of affairs was like for Norway for much of the war, being an occupied nation, occupied by Nazi Germany, and what was it like to live there?
Right,
and as
right,
you describe well, that, of course, we want to hear about the so-called Quislings, who followed the puppet dictator put in place. They are a very ominous presence in this novel.
Sure. Well, just to start with that, suspense novels, not only need a strong hero, and we have one, and I'm sure we'll talk about Kurt in a minute, but it also needs powerful villains. And while the Nazis make for easy, bad guys throughout literary, thriller history, there seems to be only one person in the United States who may not feel that way. But I actually chose someone who knew Kurt, knew my hero at an early age, who sat in the back of a classroom and sort of stared daggers at him because he was always the one who didn't do well in school and wasn't that popular and good with the gals and didn't ski the best. And Kurt Nordstrom was the one that got all the attention and all the favor, you know, as one of these people that always stood out for his achievements. And Dieter Lund, my bad guy in this, is really a member of the Quisling National Samling Party, the secret police. And Quisling was a real person. It's become to be one of those words that, eponymous words that is synonymous with a turncoat or a traitor. Quisling with a small Q, but Quisling with a large Q, Verdun Quisling, was someone who came in and took over the government, seized control of the government, a fascist, after the Norwegian king fled when the Nazis occupied the country. And he took over and instituted his own secret police that was very much sort of based on the Gestapo. And it wasn't so much the Germans that ordinary Norwegians felt in fear of, but their own secret police that were created with, sort of ne'er-do-wells and people that either didn't have the courage to maybe sign up and fight in the resistance or just, you know, people that had been in prison or people who were just sort of making an opportunist bet that the Nazis would win. These were the, people that manned this secret police force. And my bad guy, who sort of sniffs out that his old nemesis, Kurt Nordstrom, is back in town, so to speak, back in the country, and maybe trying to blow up this factory where atomic research is taking place, is here. So it's really sort of a cat and mouse game for those of you who may have seen, Les Mis in theater. It's that Inspector Javert sort of one-sided, intractable view of right and wrong that sort of makes this kind of a cat and mouse game and provides a lot of the suspense to entrap our hero. So basically Norway was filled with 300,000 German troops. There was at some point a little worry on Hitler's part that this would be the source of the quote-unquote D-Day and Normandy invasion because of the massive irregular coastline that would make it virtually impossible to defend the way, the northern coast of France he thought could be defended. So you had this mix of the secret police that would handle domestic issues and the Nazis and the Gestapo that took over this country and forced everyday Norwegians to kind of make a choice between whether they were going to sit with whether they were collaborators or whether they were people that would stand up and fight back.
Right. And I think you've helped us understand how those who chose to join the resistance were making an even more death-defying choice than we might assume, because as you just pointed out, it wasn't just the Nazis themselves who were the enemy, but also some of their fellow Norwegians who, in a sense, had stepped over to the
Definitely.
Dark side. So your protagonist, Kurt Nordstrom, is part of this resistance. And at one point, you have him thinking to himself and reflecting on recent incidents and what might be ahead. No one knew how to wage a fight. Still, they'd left their mark on the bastards. Pointing to the fact that in some respects this resistance could not be carried out by any standard rules of warfare, and there had to be great imagination and creativity, to say nothing of incredible courage.
Incredible courage. Well, basically, it started out as a real army, kind of a ragtag army, but a real army that stood up to the Blitzkrieg. But they were outnumbered, they were outmanned soon, they were just overrun by tanks and air. Some of the fighting became hand-to-hand. Kurt, when we meet him, is a courageous resistance fighter whose regiment has been completely overrun run. He's a fighter without anyone to fight with anymore. He and his pal Jens, he's a guy that's lost everything in the war. His fiance has been killed, his regiment decimated, and his country overrun and occupied. But he's one of those people that you would like in your foxhole with you, because he's one of those guys that has an innate sense of right and wrong and willing to put himself up to defend it.
Mm.
And when we meet him, he's been called by an old friend of his back to the town of his birth and upbringing, in Rikon, which is a small town sort of in the central part of southern central part of the country that is right under this block of desolate land called the Hardanger Vidda. Vidda is just Norwegian for plateau, this endless, 1,000 square miles of literally desolation and wilderness and ice and rock that this factory is built into. And what's taking place at this factory is the development of heavy water, which is a compound that has an extra deuterium isotope. Hydrogen usually has one. In this case, it's synthesized like one drop for 70 parts water. There's one part of this that can be synthesized of heavy water. So it needs enormous amounts of water and enormous amounts of available energy to synthesize this. And there's one place in the world that it's being done, and it's in this obscure factory that's tucked into this gorge in Norway that it's impossible to get to, impossible to bomb, yet what's going on there is the creation of this heavy water that is needed in isotope separation in order to create an atomic bomb, actually the way the Nazis were attempting to create the atomic bomb. So when the Allies... Nordstrom is sort of given a toothpaste container to start this book by one of the engineers in the plant, and inside is microfilm that shows the increase in the development of heavy water, which could only mean one thing. It is, in fact, the most strategic and valuable toothpaste tube in all of Europe, and they have to get it to the right hands, and the right hands are in England. So when we meet him, it gives Nordstrom a new mission, and they conduct a pretty daring escape to get from Norway to England across the North Sea.
And at one point, this is even before that trip has occurred, I mean, Kurt Nordstrom is, of course, very well aware of this Free Norwegian Army having been formed and, in a sense, headquartered in London, which is where the King of Norway has fled to safety. But, I mean, at this moment in time, this far into the war, Kurt Nordstrom thinks to himself the task of making his way to London would be about the same as making his way to China.
Right.
I mean, it might as well be China in terms of how dangerous impossible it would be for him to get there.
Yep, this is true, and so we see him as a courageous guy, and yet all he longs for is once he gets to England and hooks up with this band of, it's called the Free Norwegian Army, but he gets hooked up into a part of it that clearly is being trained for a mission to go back. All he wants to do is go back and fight again and try to help free his country, and he feels that he's being wasted and just sitting around training endlessly in England. And so the story to this point is really, the story of how they undertake this raid where only a band of these trained Norwegians are capable of executing this raid. But you can Google this or Wikipedia it, and you can sort of see what the outcomes are, because I've clearly kept it accurate. But the story moves into other areas, he wants the first raid is executed with some success, stays behind, and in his staying behind, a man who's lost everything and a man who just believes he will fight out until he dies, meets someone, connects to someone who he believes can be someone that he could form a life with after the war. And there is a bit of a romance or a budding romance to this story, and it does sort of offer a measure of hope, perhaps, to think that after all of this death and blood given, and, you know, if he can successfully complete his mission, that maybe there's a chance of it. And, of course, as it turns out, in order to fully stop the Nazis from transporting this quantity of heavy water back to back to Germany, where we know what it'll be used for, he has to put the person that he's grown to love in mortal peril in order to execute his mission. So there is a moral choice whether he can fulfill it and potentially hurt or kill the person that he's grown to love, or whether his heart has to be put aside again, and he really just is a creature who has to fulfill the sense of duty that history has sort of put him at the crossroads of.
I love the way you, in a sense, crafted, built this character of Kurt Nordstrom, who, of course, is largely based on a courageous Norwegian freedom fighter, a resistance fighter.
Right.
I particularly appreciate his personality and the fact that he is, in many respects, a figure of towering heroism, and yet he also feels like an ordinary and very real human being. Could you just say a word about what you thought of about as the author in terms of crafting this character to whom we feel this enormous affinity and ultimately great affection as well?
Yeah, well, he's a humble guy. He's a regular guy. He was an engineer by trade in the book, and he's someone who is sort of drafted into a hero's role. You know, he is one of those people that maybe everyone always looked up to as they were young. You know, someone who was athletic and someone who was good looking and someone who wasn't afraid to stand up and do the hard thing. But ultimately, he forms in this band of people who are just like him. I mean, everybody on this mission really is just like him. And, you would know, he said you're half Norwegian. These are not people that are driven really by ego. These are sort of humble people that would really just want to do nothing but farm. These aren't even military people. These are just people who were imbued with a strong sense of something larger than themselves. And on this mission that they're on, clearly they don't believe that any of them are even going to survive it, because the odds are so long and the German defense is so strong. And something we haven't mentioned yet, but probably should, the Norwegian winters, the weather, which is almost like a character in this book.
Oh, absolutely.
So ferocious, you know. But they don't back down. They never hesitate for a second to do what they assume will cost them all or most of them their lives.
And I certainly meant to say that, too, that you describe the incredibly brutal conditions in which they find themselves as they approach this stronghold in such amazing fashion. I mean, we actually sort of feel like drawing a blanket around ourselves because we just feel the bitter cold, and it only heightens the incredible sense of danger.
Well, this mission had to take place in the winter, because what they did was parachute these teams on top of the Vita. So they had to cross over the German defenses, and obviously during the summer months, the sky is light in Norway, and the planes would be seen and shot out of the sky. No one had ever parachuted people onto the Vita before, and certainly this desolate terrain was not capable of really sustaining life. And there was an advance party that was put down, and they eventually have to stay for 3.5 months with rations that were only meant for 3 weeks. But Because it's February, and when Nordstrom's team is parachuted on, and they land, and they finally get their supplies together that are parachuted down after them, they have no idea where they are. They're trying to meet up with their countrymen, that advance team. They think they're in a place, but it ends up being like 20 miles away, and all of a sudden the storm hits, and you know, it's not a storm that anyone has ever lived through before. It's you know, here we are with what's going on in Houston, but this is a ferocious, howling, you know, just like end of the world kind of storm of you know where they have to go 20 miles into the face of these winds, these biting winds with way sub freezing temperatures, and literally it's 5 days of hell. And if these people didn't literally stumble on a fortuitous cabin that was there, more like run right into it because they couldn't even see it. The visibility was so bad. They would have all perished on their first night in Norway, and this story would never have been written, and then who knows how history would have changed.
It really makes you think. And, of course, even though we know that at least on the big canvas, the story ends happily, or as we want it to end, it still reads like an absolute suspense thriller. And you've done an amazing job of telling this amazing story. The book, again, is The Saboteur, the latest novel of Andrew Gross, published by Minotaur Books. Andrew Gross, thank you so much, and congratulations on a fantastic book. I loved it, and I'm so glad we got to talk about it today.
Thanks a lot, Greg. Great to be with you.
And the time is 8:36. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD. Here's part two.
I have been devouring over the last couple of days an extraordinary series of books, and I suspect that some of you have already heard about the trilogy known as The School for Good and Evil. The last of these three books has just been published by Soman Chenani, and these are extraordinarily powerful, vivid stories in which we have fairy tales, in a sense, turned on their ears. And our notions of what is good and what is evil very much challenged. And a wonderful scenario has been created by Mr. Chenani. And these books have been so popular that that they are destined now for a major motion picture treatment. And so these wonderful adventures are soon to be seen on the big screen. But in the meantime, we finally have the opportunity to take in hand the last of these three books, the last in this trilogy called The School for Good and Evil, The Last Ever After. And I'm very excited to speak with Soman Chenani, the highly regarded author of these very, very fine and popular books, popular both here and abroad. The books are published by HarperCollins. And Soman Chenani, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's been quite exciting for me to explore these books for the first time. I'm still in the midst of actually finishing them all and taking this amazing world in. Let's talk about you for a moment. You describe yourself in your biography as having gone to Harvard University and graduated summa cum laude with what's described as something of a self-designed fairy tale major. Tell us more about your own personal love of fairy tales, and in particular, what you explored in the world of fairy tales at a place like Harvard University.
Sure. I mean, I grew up in sort of the era without cable and internet and video games and all that stuff. So it was always a challenge, I think, for parents to figure out how to entertain their kids, you know, because there wasn't just much around. And I just think my parents' kind of solution to having three boys was to buy the entire Disney animated collection. And we were basically raised by Disney for most of our life. You know, I must have seen every Disney movie 1,000 times. And so to me, that's what fairy tales were. You know, I just associated them strictly with the Disney storyline. So when I went to Harvard your freshman year, you're put into a freshman seminar with 15 kids. And it becomes kind of the most important class you take because, you know, when you're a freshman, you're always in these big lecture classes, and finally you have the chance to have this kind of intimate conversation, you know, with your classmates. And I had tried out for all these classes and got rejected from all of them because it's a bit of a lottery system, and got put in a class called Fairy Tales and the Culture of Childhood with this sort of, you know, famous fairy tale scholar. And I just was so annoyed because I felt like, you know, I grew up on Disney and sort of over the whole thing, and here we are again in the fairy tales class. And thank God I was in that class because I finally discovered what the real stories were. You know, we looked so much at just, you know, how the stories have changed from the Grimm's time when the stories were much more designed for almost older children. They were about, you know, the rite of passages. They were a survival guide to life. You know, it was this idea that there was no distinct period of adolescence in kind of, you know, medieval and 1800s literature or life. It was that fairy tales sort of bridged what it was like to go from being a kid to an adult and sort of teach kids how not to die, you know, and not to end up, you know, in sort of dangerous situations. And so I started, that's when I started thinking, you know, how did we end up at Disney? Like, no, you know, how did we end up with such coddling sort of like, you know, sanitized stories? And was there a way for me to write my own? You know, and that's when I sort of delved into, you know, what does a fairy tale mean? And sort of spent my 4 years at Harvard trying to understand what really makes a fairy tale compelling at its core, you know, and coming up with those things. So I sort of came up with the recipe of the brew that I wanted to make when I wrote my own series, and that's how the whole thing started.
Mm-hmm. You happen to be Indian American, and I wonder, in your own makeup, in terms of the kind of stories that have been important to you and the way in which you have approached these very familiar fairy tales that I think most Americans mistakenly think of as somehow all American tales, and of course, these most of these great fairy tales really don't belong to us and our own tradition at all. I just wonder, do you see any of this, or do you come at any of this looking through, in a sense, your own Indian American eyes from that part of your own personal legacy or history?
I think, you know, what ends up happening is when you grow up not strictly American, you know, when you grow up sort of with a different color skin in this country, I think you, without question, unless you happen to grow up in a suburb, you know, that has that sort of minority population in bigger numbers, I think you have what I call minority stress, which is that you're fully aware that you are different from other people, you know, and I think that became crucial. I don't know if I could have written this series if I had grown up strictly, you know, like a white American. I think this, the element of being on the outside at times and feeling on the outside at times sort of motivates the book, because the book series is about, you know, these two schools, a school for good and a school for evil, that are in balance. And, you know, for many years, no one knows who's going to win. And it's not like a story where good always wins. And the key I wanted to have in this particular story is that you could root for the evil kids as much as the good kids. And I think as people read the books, they start to realize that the evil kids are the outsiders, you know, sort of deemed by society, the ones who are considered different for the most part. And the good kids are the more mainstream, sort of conventionally accepted kids in terms of attractiveness and personality. And at the beginning of the books, you might root for the good kids, only to, as time goes on, start to fall in love with the evil kids. And I think that was sort of the ambition kind of in my own life, and also just in terms of my own self-acceptance when I was a teenager, like going from feeling like the outsider to starting to appreciate my own quirks and stuff. So, you know, the series is quite personal at a number of levels.
We're speaking with Somani Chainani about his series of three books called The School for Good and Evil. And the third in the series, subtitled The Last Ever After, has just been published. All three of these books are destined for treatment on the motion picture screen. One of the most intriguing things about the world that you have created here is what happens to whisk off certain young children to this school for good and evil. Tell us about that scenario, about the village in which the two crucial characters of Sophie and Agatha live, and the strange thing which occurs to them and to other children from that village.
Sure. So the story takes place in this town, which is a little bit like a storybook town, and every 4 years, two kids get kidnapped to this school. The best behaved kid in town gets kidnapped to the school for good. The worst behaved kid in town gets kidnapped to the school for evil. It's not like, you know, another magical school or like Hogwarts or something like that where kids actually want to go and they're sort of an advantage to going. No one wants to go to the school for good and evil because if you go, you're sort of kidnapped forever. You never come home. You never see your family again or friends again or anything like that. The next time anybody sees you is when you show up in a fairy tale, either as, you know, a hero or a villain or a sidekick or a henchman or even as an enchanted animal or a plant. You know?
And we should mention that the parents of this village do everything they can as sort of that zero-hour approaches again. They do everything they can to barricade their children in their huts and stand out there with torches. I mean, they do not, in a sense, take this lying down. They do not passively accept this.
And for 200 years, they've tried all, you know, whatever they can to prevent it from happening. It's just, it always happens, you know. So it's one of these things where every 4 years they try new strategies, you know, they'll try anything, but it never works, you know. And so especially this year, they always know who's going to get kidnapped for the most part because it's quite obvious to them who the best behaved kid and the worst behaved kid is. You know, sometimes they're surprised. But in this particular year, it's obvious to them that Sophie, who dresses in pink and, you know, thinks she's a princess and does good deeds the way a princess would. She, you know, feeds homeless people, sings to animals, does everything she thinks a typical princess would do. Because she's the only girl ever in the history of this town to want to be kidnapped. You know, she doesn't like her family all that much. She thinks the town is incredibly boring. She thinks she's destined for this great big life. And so she actually wants to be kidnapped and go to the School for Good and Evil and live out her own fairy tale as a princess with, you know, a rich, famous prince. And so, you know, she isn't sure she's going to get kidnapped. She's a bit, you know, competitive and unsure whether she is the best behaved kid in town, even though everyone else thinks she is. And so she tries to come up with her trump card, good deed, and she discovers that the best thing she can do is to make friends with Agatha, who everyone knows is going to get kidnapped to the school for evil. Because as Sophie thinks, you know, if I make friends with a villain, then, you know, that's the ultimate good deed. So Agatha lives in a graveyard. She wears black every day. She's sort of your prototypical goth girl. You know, she has a black cat. Like, every possible stereotype of a witch Agatha fulfills. And so the two of them do indeed get kidnapped, you know, as everyone predicts. And Sophie's going to go to the school for good, and Agatha's going to go to the school for evil. And, of course, when this bird sort of takes them through this crazy journey over the forest to the schools and ends up dropping them into their schools, it mixes them up and drops Sophie into the school for evil with all these, you know, future murderers and monsters and kids of fairy tale villains, and drops Agatha into the school for good with all these, you know, princes and princesses to be. And so the question that sort of dominates the whole series is why? Why did that switch happen? What does it mean? Are the girls going to get back to where they're supposed to be? Are they going to get back home? You know, and it's just about, it's at its core, it's a story of friendship played out against like the highest stakes imaginable.
One of the things I appreciate about that scenario is that for each of them, that is for Sophie and for Agatha, they are at the start of this caught in something awful. I mean, because they each are so terribly out of place. So even Agatha, who is in the school for good with all of this, I mean, in a sense, a real Disney scenario all around. Everything is glittering and pretty and beautiful and so on. And she just can't stand to be there because she does not fit. And likewise, of course, Sophie on the other side, who is in this dark, evil, menacing place, awful place. But in a sense, for each of them, it is terrible to have that sense of being such an outsider, what you were talking about before. And I think right there is the heart of the matter, and that gets us thinking so much about your central premise of what does it mean to be good, what does it mean to be evil, and what does it mean to be, in a sense, on the outside looking in, feeling like you don't belong.
And also to question, you know, what we think of these terms. I mean, I think the whole point of the series is each book sort of takes words that we've already crystallized and then sort of, you know, blows them up. So the first book looks at good and evil. The second book looks at boys and girls, which to kids, you know, are taught quite sort of stagnant terms of what it means to be a boy, what it means to be a girl, how to act like a boy, act like a girl, you know, and the second book sort of completely messes with that. So by the end, even, you know, the reader's confused as to who actually is a boy or a girl anymore in the world once they start switching genders with, you know, magic and things. And then the third book is about old and young, you know, which are terms we also think that we've got all, you know, fixed up and set. So the whole point of the series is to kind of really, unpack these terms and deconstruct them and play with them, you know, in a way that not just kids can enjoy, but also adults. Because when I write the series, I don't think of it as writing for kids at all. I write it more for me, really, like what I find, you know, compelling and interesting. And occasionally we'll have to tone something down a touch for kids, but not much. You know, this is considered one of the edgiest series out there for kids.
It's another thing I like about it. Sophie and Agatha have something else that's kind of distinctive about them within the context of this intriguing school for good and evil. Not only do they seem to have been each dropped into the wrong half of the school, but on top of it, they are regarded by the other students there as readers. Tell our listeners about that distinction, what makes them sort of interesting inhabitants of this world.
Well, I think everybody else in the world, you know, either comes from a fairy tale lineage or, you know, they are part of an enchanted world. They accept magic in their lives, you know, and so there's this, the village from which Sophie and Agatha comes from is outside all that. And the idea being that, you know, they can only read about it. They have no access to that world. And so they're called readers because, you know, they'll never have access to that world unless they're kidnapped in. And so when these two kids are brought every 4 years to the school, the two readers, and in this case it's Sophie and Agatha, the other kids find them quite sort of, underwhelming. And also just not worthy of attention because they feel like these kids have grown up so outside of enchantment and magic that they can't possibly know anything. And in general, these kids tend to fail out of school anyway. And if you fail at this school, you kind of disappear and are never seen from again, you know. So readers tend to have a bad reputation. And then, of course, Sophie and Agatha come and sort of completely throw the school into upheaval and make everyone reassess their ideas of what a reader is. But, you know, I think it also helps readers of the series sort of feel what we often do when we read fairy tales, which is outside, again, this whole theme of being outside something. Because, you know, you're reading fairy tales wishing you could be part of that magical world, and now you have two kids with the same thing and now are actually in it. You know,
right, exactly.
The consequences of that, you know? And the consequences are no one takes you seriously. It's not like you show up. In a lot of stories, like, the kids show up in a magical world and everyone bows down to them as king and queen. I feel like that happens in so many fantasy books. Like, you enter and they're like, oh, you are the lost prophet. You are the one who's supposed to be king. And this is a complete opposite. It's like they enter the world and everyone's like, okay, how long until they die?
Right, and what are you doing here?
So, what are you doing here? Like, and you know, you're not going to last very long.
I am very intrigued by the way in which they are welcomed into this school by the figures of Castor and Pollux, and who then describe, speaking to everybody who's there, the fact that those who are evil cannot be good and those who are good cannot be evil no matter how much you're persuaded or punished. Now, sometimes you may feel the stirrings of both, but this just means your family tree has branches where good and evil have toxically mixed. But here at the School for Good and Evil, we will rid you of stirrings. We will rid you of confusion. We will try to make you as pure as possible. So in other words, this school, right from the start, seemingly is set up to delineate the realms of good and evil in the clearest possible fashion in order then for these fairy tale stories to be created with as much clarity and, in a sense, simplicity as possible. And, of course, ultimately your whole series calls that understanding of fairy tales into question, that black and white good and evil thing. Ultimately, your series embraces an intriguing mix of the two, a blending of the two.
Completely, because it's, you know, when he says it, you sort of take it at face value because it's your orientation to the school, so you actually believe him. And then, you know, as you come to read the series, you start to realize that that conception is very Disney. You know, it's very, like, it's very Disney, and it's also sort of that reflective of our politics, I think, to some level in our country today, this idea of, like, you can only be one or the other. Like, you can only be on this side or that side. You know, like, everything is trying to create these camps. And I think, I don't know if that's just, you know, contemporary culture or whether it's just our attempt to categorize things. But, you know, I wanted to sort of bring that up in terms of how the school was constructed. So it's very much like, okay, you can only be on one side or the other. And this school is dedicated to making you be on one side or the other. And then, of course, these two girls do everything they can to blur the line.
Right. I love how the schools are constructed with the various classes that that they take, whether it's beautiful grooming or uglification or whatever it might be, depending on which school you're part of. I'm glad that you mentioned a certain school that starts with H, which features a small boy with glasses and a scar on his forehead, because I only want to mention that that school, which will not be named, because I really appreciate the fact that you have created a world and a universe that is so distinctive with its voice. It does not for a moment feel derivative. That being said, I wonder how much you consciously felt like you needed to create a distinctive universe that would not be seen as derivative of other really powerhouse franchises which have come before you, or was it not necessary? Were you able to just kind of create this distinctive world without even worrying about keeping sort of outside influences out of the mix?
Right. It's such a good question. I mean, I think it's funny because I've had the idea for a long time, and I just couldn't write it because I was sort of afraid of Harry Potter, I think, at some level, because, you know, it was still in the midst of happening, you know, like the movies were still coming out and everything. So I let go of the idea. I just said, I know I have this great idea and I know it's something I'd love to do, but I don't know how to do this, you know, in any way to get away from this. And so it took about, you know, 4 or 5 years after that last movie came out. And that's when I started thinking, you know, what's different about this from that? And I realized the core message, I think, was different. I think not just the core message, but also the voice, you know. And I think what's different about the two is that at some level, Harry Potter is very much a tale of, you know, good battling against the ultimate evil, you know. And I think School for Evil is all about, well, what do those terms mean? You know, like, say it would almost be as if in Harry Potter we follow the Slytherin kids, you know, fighting Harry, and then have to determine, well, who are we siding with once we know the Slytherin kids' stories. Like, my sort of fundamental thesis is, once we know everybody's story, where they come from, what motivates the things they do, can you really root against them? You know, like, can you really call someone evil once you know their history and where they come from? Like, and you actually read their thoughts and you read their life and understand what's motivating their actions, then how easy is it to brand someone something, you know? And so I went into it with this kind of very truthful voice, where I just sort of try to come at it from the most kind of honest, clear way. And so the narrator in School for Evil is quite edgier than most children's narrators, because he's not warm. He's not, you know, like, knowingly snarky or anything like that. It's just, it's a very, very flat, straightforward narrator that sort of calls it as it is, you know, and doesn't take sides. And so I think those were kind of the differences. And as I went on, you know, it's funny, like, I remember when the book was first coming out, that first series, all the, like, all the promo and everything kept mentioning, oh, is this going to be like Harry Potter? This is like Harry Potter. And then by the time the second book came out, we never saw the words again. I mean, it just doesn't show up in any of the reviews, the reactions, the comparisons anymore, just because it's different. It's just so different.
You it know, really
I
is.
I don't think I would have been able to write it.
It's different in a fascinating, compelling way. Again, this is the series called The School for Good and Evil, and the last of the trilogy, which is called The Last Ever After, is just published by HarperCollins. Soman Chainani, congratulations on these superb books. We look forward to seeing these treated as a motion picture series, and I hope that all goes well with you as you continue to create these wonderful stories for the world. Best wishes.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And tomorrow on the morning show, two exciting interviews, one of them with Joshua Levine, a historic consultant for the recent film Dunkirk. and the author of a book called Dunkirk, The History Behind the Motion Picture. Dunkirk, one of the most crucial moments in the Second World War, and to this day, one of the least understood and appreciated. Also, you'll hear my conversation with India Hicks, who was a bridesmaid to the wedding of Prince Charles and Lady Diana.